Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Well, you probably might have even listened or watched on television the State of the Union message last night by Barack Obama. A little later in the program, actually within a few minutes, I'd like to do maybe what might be considered a state of the world from a very, one might say, narrow perspective, but perhaps it might be the widest of all perspectives. Prior to that, however, I'd like to read just a little something about the Supreme Court. And I started it off, some scribbling I have done, to lead into something else. They will be able to spend oodles squared. And that's a response to the Supreme Court ruling that corporations can spend unlimited amounts of money in politics. And this is something I wrote, so therefore attribute it to my opinion and perhaps my opinion only in the entire cosmos. The two disasters in American politics this past month of January 2010, the election of a Massachusetts Republican to fill out the deceased Ted Kennedy's Senate seat, which ends the Democrats' 60-member double majority, you might say, and the Supreme Court decision that money is the equal of the citizenry in its constitutional rights, which overturns nearly a century of attempting to limit the importance of money in political campaigns. This ruling gives corporations a phenomenally larger equality than ordinary citizens enjoy. These two travesties must awaken Congress to the long, bitter slide toward promiscuous as well as pernicious corruption that it has taken. The health care issue clearly demonstrates the power of private megacorporations over democratic government, endorsed by the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that corporations, already defined by an earlier Supreme Court as individuals that have all the rights of human citizens, but none of the obligations, also enjoy their individual rights of unlimited campaign donations. Money is free speech. And that was the usual 5-4 ruling that underwrites the aristocracy of corporate dominance of American politics. And this usual 5-4 ruling is thanks to George W. And this leads into a letter to the Daily Astorian that I think really is very succinct in this particular issue. It's written by an attorney named Lawrence Rosenkratz, Northwest Portland, and it was a letter to the Oregonian on last Saturday, the 23rd. Quote, "Night falls on America." That's the lead to it, or the slug. "Our citizen democracy is about to die, not at the sound of a gun, but by the quiet sound of dollars changing hands. Under the guise of extending free speech rights for corporations, the Bush majority on the Supreme Court has provided the means to muffle citizen speech. Their decision to do so was by disregarding decades of established law and on the false premise that corporations are persons entitled to human rights. The greatest loser in all of this is our once again citizen democracy. Domestic or even foreign corporations can now mount their own political campaigns thanks to this decision. The truth be damned. Attempts to regulate safety, limit financial speculation, control global warming, provide affordable health care, and anything else that impinges on corporate profitability will result in the advocate being dispatched from office in favor of more compliant legislators. Unions will be legislated out of existence. Social programs will be viewed as wasteful and eliminated. Restrictions on corporate excesses will be repealed, and the taxes imposed on the middle class and the poor will fund corporate welfare instead. This is one of the darkest days for our once citizen democracy brought to us by the same Supreme Court majority that installed George W. Bush as president. Put a for sale sign on our democracy. The greater good and the public interest no longer have a meaningful voice. As an attorney, I am appalled at this errant and disastrous ruling. As a citizen, I am saddened and fearful of the harm to our democracy this abominable ruling portends." And that's Lawrence Rosenkrantz, I beg your pardon. And that was a letter he wrote to the Daily Oregonian, on Saturday, the 23rd of January, 2010. And I think it very nicely sums up the problem. For all of my misreading of that, Well, as I said earlier, that President Obama made a State of the Nation speech last night, his first in his presidency. And I'd like to read something by Dave Lindorf, who is a Philadelphia-based investigative journalist and columnist. His work available at www.thiscan'tbehappening.net and www.counterpunch.org. And he wrote something called A Terrifying Truth, which is more a state of the world from his perspective and many others. A Terrifying Truth by Dave Lindorf. It wasn't too long ago that the death of socialism, the triumph of capitalism, and the end of history were widely hailed. What a difference a few years and a few fractions of a degree in world temperature change makes. We may still be contemplating the end of history, but of a different sort. It is suddenly becoming painfully obvious that the pursuit of profit and the philosophy of growth for growth's sake and of dog-eat-dog is about to kill us off. Now that it has been proven beyond any reasonable doubt that the Earth is headed for a global heat wave, the likes of which hasn't been seen in hundreds of thousands and perhaps tens of millions of years, the kind of killing heat that in the past has led to mass extinctions, it is ludicrous to talk about things like carbon trading and raising vehicle mileage standards. We need a revolution in the way we human beings live and the way we treat each other. There is no way that the world's 6.5 billion people, and counting, and especially the 2 billion of them who live in wealthier societies, can continue to consume energy at even close to the level that we have been consuming it. There is no way we in the developed world can continue to live the way we have been living, in oversized houses, heated in winter and cooled in summer. There is no way in the Northern Hemisphere we can continue to have teakwood or mahogany-floored living rooms and eat strawberries in December. There is no way we can continue to squander trillions of dollars on war and military spending every year. No way, that is, if we plan on leaving a livable world for our children and grandchildren. The so-called green politicians who talk about instituting carbon trading schemes, about driving hybrid automobiles, about buying fluorescent light bulbs, and about turning down the thermostat and wearing sweaters are deceiving us or themselves. None of this is going to save us. What will save us is recognizing the age of consumer-driven capitalism is over. We either come up with a new way to organize society in which production is based upon real needs, not upon manufactured needs, and in which scarce resources are made available to those who need them, not just to those who can afford them, or we will all be doomed, or at least our progeny. The peoples of the world, especially of the developed world, but really everywhere, need to recognize that unless our expectations are changed, unless our selfish desire for more is curbed, unless wasteful production is ended, we are all likely to be on that extinction list. So where are the leaders of boldness and vision in politics, media, and academia who are ready to tell the truth? Where are the people who are willing to listen to and reward that truth-telling? This is not an inconvenient truth we need to confront. It is a terrifying truth. We need to change everything, and we need to do it quickly, too. Here in America, that means an end to subsidies for suburban sprawl. There should be no more federal or state funds for road building and road repair. If people want to live miles away from where they work, let them pave their own roads. That's the only way to get people to realize they're going to have to start supporting funding for mass transit and to start thinking about living near where they work. We need to end subsidies for agribusiness, which has virtually decimated local agriculture to the point that prime farm states like Pennsylvania and New Jersey now import all their food from the West Coast. Ridiculous. We need to levy a massive tax on gasoline so that no one will buy cars and so that those who have them will drive only rarely. Large, heavy vehicles for personal use should be outright banned. Trucks, too, should be heavily taxed, so that products will reflect the true cost of the environmental damage that shipping them around costs. Electricity and home heating fuel should also be heavily taxed, with some kind of rebate program for low-income families so that people will stop heating and cooling large homes. As these things are done, there clearly will be massive dislocation. People who live in hot climes like Florida or Arizona will no doubt decide they can't afford to cool their homes and will move north. People in cold regions may decide it's too expensive to heat their homes and will move to more temperate zones. Companies like the Detroit automakers will go bust or shrink enormously. Power plants will be shut down. Oil companies will go bankrupt. That all has to happen, but it doesn't mean people have to starve. We as a society need to demand a government that will help those who are displaced by the crisis to relocate and to find new productive ways to earn a living. A huge government program of investment in alternative energy systems would be able to hire many of those whose jobs are lost by the shutdown of the carbon economy. A new ethos needs to be developed. Conspicuous consumption, egoism, and the so-called American dream of having it all for oneself and one's family need to be replaced with a new, actually a very old, concept, communalism. Instead of thinking of ourselves as consumers and competitive free agents, we need to start thinking of ourselves as passengers on a boat that is sinking. If we all run for the lifeboats and life preservers and fight to see who can be saved, the life vests will be torn and ruined, and the lifeboats will fall into the sea and sink. In the end, we will all go down. If, on the other hand, we change tack, recognize that we are all in this together, and make orderly plans to save ourselves collectively, we may all be able to get away. To succeed, we need to acknowledge that everyone is at risk, everyone is contributing to the common goal of survival, and everyone will be taken care of. The same approach needs to be taken in the larger world. If the poorer nations believe that they are going to be abandoned to catastrophe and famine, they will do two things. Continue to try and survive by the old strategies of wasteful energy use and environmental destruction and of mass migration to safer havens. The first response, for example, the continued destruction and burning down of rainforests for wood and cropland and ethanol feedstocks, will threaten us all with ever-worsening global warming. The second will lead to overcrowding of more fortunately situated nations and a drain on their resources. The only answer is, again, for all the wealthy nations and those that are better situated by geography to survive climate change, to commit themselves to helping the more threatened nations and societies. This is not a matter of altruism. It is a simple logic of survival. But before we can start making the huge changes that are called for, really the dismantling of the whole capitalist system and the free market ethos, we need to start hearing and demanding to hear the truth. From scientists, from politicians, from business leaders, from the media, and ultimately from ourselves. For starters, let's stop kidding ourselves that the latest United Nations report on climate change is the real story. That report, ominous as it sounds, doesn't tell the half of it. The report was first watered down by the scientists who reviewed it, and then it was censored by the governments that feared its findings. For one thing, it didn't even mention that all the projections for warming during this century don't even take into consideration the role that hundreds of billions of tons of methane gas underlying the Arctic and Antarctic permafrost and trillions of tons of methane laying in the form of frozen hydrates deep under the ocean could play if that super global warming gas should start pouring out into the atmosphere. We are in a situation where it is wholly inappropriate to act on optimistic assumptions. Rather, we need to consider worst-case scenarios and start planning and acting with those in mind. That means, for example, that to keep the methane fiasco from occurring, we don't want the permafrost to go away in the polar regions. We don't want the oceans to warm precipitously, and we don't want the ice caps to melt away. That means we have to act much more dramatically than just worrying about coastal erosion and lowered crop yields might lead us to do. This is a crisis that isn't going away. It is a crisis that isn't going to be solved with Band-Aids. It is a crisis that isn't going to be solved by smooth talk. And it is a crisis that will get worse the longer we take to recognize its true gravity, and the longer we take to recognize its true gravity, and the longer we take to face up to the revolution that needs to take place if we are able to prevent it. And that is the truth. And that was David Lindorf, A Terrifying Truth. And He is a Philadelphia-based investigative journalist and columnist whose work is available at www.thiscan'tbehappening.net and www.counterpunch.org. His home will be submerged when the Greenland ice cap melts, as he says in his little bio about himself. Well, I'd like to read something that I wrote. So again, my disclaimer is in place. Liberating Haiti. Haiti seldom catches our attention except through travesty or tragedy. Just now, we are horrified by the immense tragedy of an earthquake in Haiti that has killed hundreds of thousands and wrecked the social engine that was too crippled to function. The world has quickly responded with floods of aid and emergency volunteers, much as it did to the earthquake and great tsunami in December 2003 that struck Southeast Asia. The United States rightly feels pressured to provide the bulk of the aid, not only because it is a close neighbor, but also because it has forced itself upon Haitian politics since the birth of both nations in the late 18th century. Haiti has been a long and deeply penetrating thorn to the United States, ever since a Haitian slave made himself king and defied European colonial power more than 200 years ago. The fledgling United States, born of revolution, did not recognize Haiti's slave revolt against France in 1791, which had taken as its mantra the liberty, fraternity, equality of France's own revolution, which was still being resolved. The French king, Louis XVI, was guillotined that year of 1791. U.S. slave owners regarded Haiti's revolution with horror, and only when the USA divided into its civil war over slavery did the Union under Abraham Lincoln recognize Haiti as a sovereign nation, and that was in 1863. After that, the United States either seemed to occupy Haiti or support horrendous dictators, such as the grotesque Papa Doc Duvalier, until late in the 20th century. Despite the racist overtones of critics who dismiss Haiti as no particular influence and who have a history of supporting military dictators, the form of government necessary to protect U.S. interests in Latin America and the Caribbean is, ironically, democracy. Democracy is a crucible upon which rests continued dominance of Haiti by the U.S., because military despots have become too unstable and dangerous. More malleable, popularly elected governments that claim the cooperation of their citizens are considerably less incendiary and less costly to exploit, though they do demand an ample share of the profits for their nation's labor and support. For that reason, the U.S. attempts to impose democracy, and I've got that in quotes, upon Haiti, though it is difficult to grasp how it can be forced upon a society and remain democratic. The U.S. tried that before in its first invasion of Haiti in 1915. Democracy's instrument was the United States Marine Corps, which imposed martial law and controlled Haitian towns, schools, and political offices while suppressing opposition parties and the local press. Taking over the economy and instituting a corvée system of slave labor to build roads without pay, the USMC also established a military caste, which subsequently ruled Haiti after the Marines left in 1934. Democracy was not the real purpose of the USMC's occupation of Haiti, but instead to tether Haiti to American political and business interests. The Marine Corps was as prepared to teach democracy to Haitians as it was to Filipinos a decade earlier, or to Vietnamese more than a half century later. Winning hearts and minds is not a primary mission of such a closed, authoritarian, and hard-nosed military corps as the USMC. After postponing popular elections in 1929, Marine machine gunners opened fire on a large crowd of demonstrating Haitians. 11 years earlier, in 1918, anger at forced labor broke out in rebellion against the Marine Corps-controlled government. The USMC managed to kill the rebel leader, but martyred him as a result, as also occurred in Nicaragua. Most Haitians hated the occupation, which finally ended when the Marines gradually withdrew in 1934, after 19 years on the island of Hispaniola, which Haiti shares with the Dominican Republic. Also a focus of periodic American attention. The Marines made landings there in 1965 to combat, quote, communist insurgents, unquote. The USMC had a three-tier approach to its policing activities in Latin America following World War I. Civic action, construction of public works and highways, and establishing local constabularies. The public construction was resented as unpaid slave labor, as demonstrated in Haiti, and civic action, a superficial attempt to encourage democracy, was undermined by the Marine-supervised gendarmerie, from which dictators invariably emerged after the USMC departed, the Somoza regime in Nicaragua, Rafael Trujillo in the Dominican Republic, and the worst of them all, Papa Doc Duvalier, and his infamously vicious Tonton Macoutes in Haiti. Once again, American troops, soldiers as well as Marines, came ashore and occupied Haiti in 1994. A pro-American military usurper was removed in favor of a democratically elected administration the military overthrew. A priest, Father Bertrand Aristide, was Haiti's first ever elected president. Although he was less than enthusiastic about American hegemony, he sought refuge in the U.S. after he was deposed by a military coup. A last-minute compromise before American troops invaded allowed the military junta, demonized as a pretext for invasion, the chance to leisurely vacate its offices and choose exile without retribution for its hideous crimes, while the dreaded police, heirs to the savage Tonton Macoutes, who terrorized Haiti during the reigns of Papa and Baby Doc, Baby was Papa's boy, kept their weapons and beat to death a few citizens in the usual manner as they gathered to welcome the American troops ashore in September that year. The specter was almost that of Vietnam in 1945, when the British rearmed Japanese soldiers to suppress independence-minded crowds. In Haiti, the butchers were spared in exchange for a bloodless occupation. The immediate reaction of Americans and presumably Haitians was relief. The only bloodshed experienced by the expeditionary force was that of bystanders killed by the hated Haitian security police. American military police quickly took over most policing duties following a storm of world criticism for permitting the junta's hired killers to suppress crowds cheering their liberation. Over the next several weeks, the generals departed in a gentlemanly way, and President Aristide returned triumphantly to wildly cheering crowds. The Haitian army seemed neutralized, and a few, but not all, of the junta's, and perhaps CIA's, gangs were disarmed. Aristide was reinstated as president, but was subsequently chased out of Haiti by the Bush administration and spent the rest of his presidency in exile. Congress hesitantly lauded President Bill Clinton for preventing bloodshed, although he bypassed the House and Senate when he declared that invasion of Haiti was imminent, creating an outcry that the president was circumventing the Constitution, which he was. But the bloodless insertion of troops by sea and air tempered criticism, and a somewhat mollified Congress said U.S. troops should be removed from Haiti as soon as possible. By inserting American troops into Haiti, Clinton reasserted U.S. dominance of the Western Hemisphere that was first emphasized in the Monroe Doctrine. Octavio Paz wrote that Latin American democracies continue to falter because they attempt to mimic democratic forms without, quote, the critical and modern intellectual current, unquote, out of which Western democracy grew. The counterpoint is that most Latin American democracies falter because the northern giant suppresses any genuine liberation movement that might challenge its supremacy in the hemisphere. Comic opera dictators might ruthlessly rule their people without interference as long as they maintain U.S. commercial and political clout in their nations. True democracy in Latin America has long been considered inimical to U.S. interests, and most opportunities for critical and modern intellectual currents of democratic evolution are usually suppressed. Yet democracy incites ever-increasing numbers despite the brutal response of American puppets, and despite its own callous repression of libertarian movements, covertly or overtly, the United States is often the model of independence sought by indigenous rebels. If the United States truly intends to democratize the Western Hemisphere, it must first quit exploiting and treating as less than equal the other people who live here. That would require acting as if Americans really do believe in democracy. And that is an article I wrote, Liberating Haiti. And now, to end the program, I'd like to sort of finish it where I started. It's an editorial by Stephen Forrester in the Monday, January 25th, 2010 issue of the Daily Astorian. Court delivers a fool's bargain. Activist judges, and that's a quote, are a favorite boogeyman of the right. But you would have listened to AM radio in vain last week for denunciations of the U.S. Supreme Court majority's decision to spurn a century of their own prior rulings and congressional acts that limited corporate political advertising. In terms of shifting the political landscape, this decision by Chief Justice John Roberts and other justices installed by Republican presidents is almost on par with their delivery of the White House to President George W. Bush in the disputed 2000 presidential race. The U.S. Constitution was written long before the rise of massively powerful multinational corporations, but the court has now turned its back on precedent and common sense by saying that Microsoft and General Electric are to be treated the same as your nice old Aunt Nellie when it comes to influencing elections. In other words, the court majority considers there to be no difference between an individual deciding on a $10 contribution and a company or union pouring millions into defeating a particularly troublesome congressman or senator or warping their legislative decisions. As a former general counsel for the Federal Election Commission imagines the conversation, "We've got a million we can spend on advertising for you or against you, whichever one you want," quote unquote. A functioning modern democracy depends on preserving a relatively level playing field for people of all backgrounds and incomes. The court is now disingenuously pretending that the Founding Fathers would draw no distinction between the actions of a corporation, a kind of fictional person created to pursue profits, and a real flesh and blood person. It is being half-heartedly argued by a few that this decision is politically neutral and that unions and progressive companies will counterbalance the more traditional anti-regulation, anti-corporate taxation positions of traditional GOP-leaning firms. This is transparently ridiculous in these days of sharply curtailed union power. More importantly, regardless of party preference, it is objectionable to permit the manipulation of elections by a few powerful people, no matter whether they sit in corporate penthouses or union offices. Some in Congress foresaw this action by the court and are trying to find ways to mitigate the damage. One proposal would require company chief executives to be identified as sponsors of campaign ads they pay for, while other proposals would seek to cut government contracts for firms that choose to play politics. It is open to doubt whether the current court majority would allow such laws to stand for long. Also very much in doubt, now are other laws limiting how much individuals and others can donate to specific politicians. By the same reasoning the court used last week, it could be argued that any limits whatsoever on individual or corporate political involvement are unconstitutional. Anyone who thought the smiling Chief Justice John Roberts would be a unifier has got it wrong. Roberts is changing the nature of our democracy on a 5-4 decision. And this is one more example of how removed the justices are from the reality of our working democracy and politics. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who had been a state legislator, would not have gone for this fool's bargain. And that was an article in the Daily Astorian, which I probably should say, I believe, was written by Stephen Forrester, the editor of the Daily A. At any rate, this has been Michael McCusker.